What do you think you're doing? You're listening to Crime Quest, a podcast covering the cold, the solved, and the theories. Join us.
All right. Hello, hello. This is Crime Quest, Season 2. It's been a while. Our last episode was in December. We took a little break to enjoy time with family over the holidays and just relax and regroup for our next season. Today we're going to be talking about some historical things, and they are, the main overarching topic is deathbed confessions.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a fun one. So how's your week been?
It's been good. Nothing too exciting to report.
Oh, good.
And I think that the cases we're talking about today are pretty interesting. Deathbed confessions are always something to look back on, and you know, you have to wonder if they're true, because someone's in this like state of they're about to cross over to the other side, you know, so they're feeling very truthful, and you have to wonder if what they're saying is actually what happened, or if they're just delirious.
Yeah, or remembering something that they didn't actually do, even though they think they did. Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll get into that, but like, why don't you start us off with the first one?
Okay, so our first story is about Emma Alice Smith, and this is actually from 1926, so this is kind of fascinating in that it's lasted since then. This is what, almost 100 years ago? How much is that? 191 years ago. So, this
83-year-old murder.
Is it 83?
It says 83-year-old.
So if it was
murder.
Those articles were old, though. So I think this is a 91 now.
Okay.
Because I guess, yeah, I don't do math well. But
okay. Gotcha.
Okay, so Emma Alice Smith, she was born into a working class family in Waldron. It was Waldron, Sussex, so I guess southeast of London, closer to the coast, I think, than actually to London. I think she had four sisters and two brothers, and she ended up in service to a family in, I think it was Tunbridge Wells is what it was. These are all such nice names. Mm-hmm. It's a lot nicer than some of the names around here. So in that family, I guess she biked to and from the train station every day to get to her job. And one of those days, she disappeared when she was 16. She was on her way to the train station. All of a sudden, she was just never came back. Never showed up to work, never came back. So there was a search for her. They never found anything. They didn't find clues. They didn't find, the bicycle. They never found a note. So where did she go? And that's the big case, or the big part of this case, is there was no indication of where she actually went until years later. So 1953 is when a man on his deathbed made a confession to her older sister that he had actually killed her and put her body in the pond, in the nearby pond.
What was Emma's job that she was?
She was a domestic servant. So I guess at 16, I'm assuming, this is just from watching too much Downton Abbey, I assume she was either like a housemaid or scullery maid, kitchen maid, something like that.
Okay.
That's just based on my very insufficient knowledge of.
Was that it sounds like that was a popular job to have.
Yeah, well, I think that was pretty, I guess, if you couldn't get a job in a factory nearby,
mm-hmm.
I think domestic service was probably, and I think it was actually a really good thing for them back then, because it was going to be more money than they were able to get working in town.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you could work your way up. So if you were good at it, you could work your way up to, I guess, ladies' maid or a cook or anything
like
that.
So just like Downton Abbey, where
yeah,
there's
exactly
certain levels of servitude.
Exactly.
Got it.
So, I think it probably would have been a good job for her. I'm not saying that all of these employers, and this is my history side talking, not all of these employers were good to their employees, so it's not like, not everybody was like Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Not everybody was nice and gave their employees Christmas presents or time off or anything like that. So I guess it was probably a decent job. We don't have any indication of whether or not she liked it a lot or not, but, you know, back then it was, you went to a job, you did your work, and you came home. Because you had to. That was the only way to survive. So, that's, after that, they really just didn't know what happened to her. She just really disappeared. She's gone in plain sight, basically. I guess the hard part is that she was on a bicycle. So the fact that they didn't find that bicycle is a little concerning. You'd think that if something had just happened to her, if she just decided to run away or something, she'd have to find a place to hide the bicycle. I mean, in that 5 miles between her house and the station, why couldn't they have found a bicycle? Unless she took it with her. I can't see if she ran away, did she take it with her? So I don't know. I don't know how easy that would have been if you're running away. Maybe she sold it, but then they would still have to find it. And then I'm sure they would still have an eyewitness of saying, you know, I bought this bicycle from her. She's going to London, or she's going to Manchester or Birmingham to do something different with their life.
It's pretty strange that they never found the bicycle.
Yeah.
And when I read the article, it said that the man that confessed to her murder was claiming that he dumped her body in a pond. Mm-hmm. And did that include the bicycle?
I have not read anything.
Oh, it says she was never seen again, and there were no clues, and there was no sign of, and no sign of anything, and there was no bicycle.
Right. So, I mean, if he had killed her, what did he do with the bicycle?
Back then, I guess, did they have dumpsters in the 1920s? Probably not.
No, but it does, I mean, he did claim that he had destroyed all the evidence, and when he disposed of her body, he also disposed of the bicycle.
Well, another thing is, like, all right, let's say that he killed her,
mm-hmm.
and the bicycle is just laying, you know, maybe sitting up against a tree or sitting out in public. Who's to say the bike just didn't get stolen by someone?
That's true.
And that person didn't come forward because it was probably, you know, it was a stolen bike and they took it. So why would they?
Yeah, I mean, if they're looking for her and they're looking for a bicycle, that I can't see somebody coming forward and saying, oh, I took the bike, but I had nothing to do with her murder.
Exactly.
Absolutely nothing.
So I feel like the bike is.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it would matter at this point if they even found the bike.
Right.
Like, especially if it was stolen. If they found it at the bottom of a pond, that's different, because at least then we would be able to determine, okay, this guy was actually telling the truth.
Right.
Because your body was found in a pond. But we still don't, there's no way to tie him to the murder other than through his own comments about it. So, I thought it was interesting So I was reading too that there was an amateur film made about
and that's actually how this whole thing started. An amateur filmmaker in Waldron Village, or in Waldron, I guess it is now. I'm not sure if it's still a village or not, or if they're two separate entities. But there's an amateur filmmaker who actually did make a film based on Emma's story, and it was called Finding Esther. But it was based on a photograph that they found of Emma from her, her stoolball team, which I had never heard of before, but it seems really neat. It's kind of a mixture of cricket, croquet, and I believe it was baseball, maybe?
Okay.
And it was sometimes called cricket in the air, And the whole reason that it was named Stoolball was because milkmaids used to take their stools and use the underside as a wicket. For that. So, and it is really popular in the Sussex, so it sounds like they had a team going and they must have competed against other, or had games against other area teams. So they actually found, the filmmakers saw the photo and had heard that, or had seen Emma's picture, and a man came up to her and actually pointed Emma out and said she was, she disappeared when she was 16, and that's why she wanted to look into the story.
Yeah, it says someone made a chance remark to someone from the local dramatic society.
Yeah.
Who,
excuse me.
Scriptwriter Valerie Chidson.
Right.
Valerie was researching old photographs and found one of Emma Smith, to which someone commented she had disappeared.
Yeah.
And soon after, she heard two women talking about how they were laying flowers on a grave, mm-hmm. and with them had an old town history book. The women were members of Emma's family.
Right.
And the women told Valerie that justice had not been done. They wanted to know what happened to her. The confessor, as we said before, claimed he had destroyed all of the evidence and disposed of her body in the pond, along with her bicycle. So he actually did say that he did that. It was Emma's aunt Lillian who heard the confession,
mm-hmm.
because Lillian was the caretaker of this man. And it says that she didn't go to the police because she was afraid of scandal, which I'm sure is very common.
Yeah, in the 50s, I can imagine that.
The motive was unknown. When Valerie began making the film, Mr. Wright, who is the nephew of Lillian, I believe,
yeah,
contacted the police, and the case was reopened. The film fantastically assumes that Valerie was having a liaison with another man, an envious onlooker, then ripped a crucifix from her neck, and she falls from her bike, fatally striking her head. So that it's insinuating that it was some sort of accident.
Right, based on some sort of crime of passion, too.
Yeah.
Which is...
So let's go back to why we think that this man may have killed her.
I think it's, there's the deathbed confession. There's really... Aside from the deathbed confession, I think that sort of just started to get around the family. And they really believed it. I mean, they don't have any reason not to believe that he did it. They never really did know what happened to her. They're completely blank on her fate. So when this guy comes out and says, I killed her, why shouldn't they believe him at this point? And I think it sounds like it kind of made the rounds through the family. It was passed down almost as family lore. And that's why the police actually ended up reopening this case in, 2010, I think. Her family went to the police and asked that they reopen the case based on this past deathbed confession. So the police did, and they even said that it wasn't so much about finding the killer at that point, because if it was this man on the deathbed doing the deathbed confession, he was gone. If it was him, they couldn't arrest him. It was more for peace of mind for mm-hmm. the family to get peace of mind for them, so they'd have something to bury or something to memorialize. The biggest problem has been that most of the ponds have dried up. So really, they said that they did have some, there wasn't so much an idea that they were gonna find her actual bones at that point. It was more an idea of using some tools to find out whether or not there were human remains detected within the soil. I find it fascinating that the police actually reopened this case 83 years later when these articles came out. So that's kind of neat to me. And I love the fact that it was because of this writer who wanted to do a short film or play based on the disappearance. So one of the other things that that was interesting was that a few years after Valerie had discovered, the filmmaker discovered this photograph, she was actually in the pub, and the man in the pub was a relative of Emma's, and he's the one that claimed that the killer had made the deathbed confession that she overheard. And then her relatives had actually chosen not to go to the police because the crime had taken place so long ago, which I guess is understandable. They don't really know. I guess the fact that even in the 50s and 60s, you wouldn't have enough evidence. I guess we didn't have the forensic stuff that we have now. So I guess finding that body would have been even harder then. Now we at least have the means to test the soil and test the ground for human remains and see if that's there. So I do like that. I'm kind of intrigued with the fact that this was a playwright who got all this going. And then once she actually premiered that film, I think it was Detective Chief Inspector. I love all the the like really cool names that you guys give to your UK police officers. Trevor Bowles, and he's in the Major Crime Branch of Sussex Police, or he was. They actually did decide to carry out that cold case review, and they codenamed it Operation Stratton, which I can't seem to find a connection for that, which makes me wonder if that has something to do with the deathbed confession. Maybe it had to do with the name of the person.
Like the person that confessed?
Yeah, but it also sounds like they don't know that person, so I'm still trying to figure out the meaning of Operation Stratton. And then since Emma's sister was dead, the hard part was going to be finding out who that man was that made the confession to her.
But what do you think the motive was for him, if he did do it, what was his motive?
I don't know, because we don't know.
It was the 1950s when he confessed, which means that he was probably in his 70s or 80s, maybe, when he was passing away. And Emma went missing in 1926.
Yeah.
So he was maybe in his 30s.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, maybe there was some sort of affair.
He was 30. It could be that he attacked her. She was alone. She was riding her bike.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be that that's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know if it was a crime of passion. We don't know if it was just a random. But then again, I think random crimes are so much more rare that if this woman was, or if her sister was actually tending the deathbed of a man, that makes me think it's someone kind of close to them. I'm curious about this. I'd really like to know who that man is. So if it was someone close, was it maybe a brother? Was it, and that's why they didn't go to police? Was it her, I don't know if her father was still alive in the 50s. Was it an uncle? Was it a cousin? I mean,
yeah.
Who?
Well, I was reading about her dad, and his name was Sidney Smith.
Right. And I don't think it was him. He was pretty distraught.
Yeah, it says that he put out an SOS in the 1960s over the radio and to try to find her, and nothing came of it.
Right.
I think that was probably right before he passed away. It says, again, like you said, many ponds in the area have disappeared since the 20s, but there are tests that can detect human remains in water, which can be done at various sites.
Yeah.
I would also be curious to know how strong a dog's nose would be in those situations, because I know that it's really old, but would they be able to pick that up, you know, something that's, almost 100 years old.
Right.
Human remains.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think we do have so many more scientific options here that I think that would, I can see that that would be it, but how would they would they be able to actually confirm that it's Emma's DNA? I guess they could use relatives, test relatives' DNA.
Yeah. It's so interesting. And even then, it's like, well, we found her, but we still don't know who the man's name that confessed is.
Yeah.
And there's no real way to tie him to it unless there's some shred of evidence left in his old belongings that family members have.
Yeah.
Which is not impossible. I mean, things happen, you know. You know, people, when they do things like this, sometimes they, you know, they may write it down somewhere or put it in some sort of cryptic poem in their journal. Like, they have a journal of dates that says, like, this is where I was at this time, and maybe a relative just happened to hold on to it. You know?
Especially back then when, I mean, I think diaries, written diaries and written documents were so much more in use back then than they are now. I mean, I know my grandmother had a diary. I feel like family members back then all had some sort of written.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
about their life.
Yeah, it seems like everybody had some sort of chronicle of what they were up to every day, and it was very popular.
Yeah. So then the case actually takes a really odd turn with the police, and this is the part that kills me, because there's no actual proof other than the police telling us this. So the Sussex police, and this is Detective Chief Inspector Trevor Bowles, the same one that originally opened the case, he treated the case as low priority, which is understandable. It's a 84-year-old murder that, or 84-year-old disappearance that probably takes a much lower priority than something that's recently occurred. He actually said that the case was closed, and the whole reason is because, one, they discovered that she had gone missing in 1928 and not 1926 as they previously thought. And it was at the same time Irish road worker Thomas Wells abandoned his wife and four children. So whether or not this is true, whether or not she did go missing in 28, although I can't see why so many family members would insist on the 1926.
Yeah, and then it's like a full 2 years later.
Yeah, and also insist on the fact that this man gave a deathbed confession and hold on to that murder idea for so long.
So what do we know about Thomas Wells?
We don't really know anything about him. We do know that...
Was he who she was working for?
No.
Oh.
He was a road worker. He was an Irishman over from the Republic. And he did disappear right around the same time. I've actually tried doing, like, an ancestry search to see if I can find him. And haven't been able to make the connection between the same man and the names that have come up. Because I was trying to see if I could link him with Emma, too.
Wow.
So, if she did, she moved to the Irish Republic with him in 1928. And the whole reason that the detectives concluded this was that they had learned about a public row at a Sunday school outing between Emma's mother and Mr. Wells' wife. And this occurred sometime between 1933 and 1936. So...
What was it? A public row?
Yeah, like an argument.
Public argument.
Yeah.
Between
her mother and his wife. So Thomas's wife and Emma's mother. So that makes me know that, or that gives us cause to believe that, you know, Emma's mother knew that she had eloped to Ireland with him. But then again, why are the sisters and the nephews and, you know, the rest of the family holding on to this idea that she was murdered?
Well, at the time, perhaps it was meant to be kept a secret.
True, but then if they're having a public argument, if other people are hearing this information...
Well, what were they arguing about?
It didn't say. But I'm guessing, I mean...
What did women typically argue with other women about?
I have no idea.
Back then.
Men.
Men. Probably the same stuff women argue about now.
Yeah, and I mean... I don't see that they would be using that as a as a reason unless the argument specifically pertained to Emma and Thomas. So there's no indication that it actually was about them, but that's what the detectives concluded, was that she and Thomas's wife had been arguing about
Emma and Thomas. So let's say that Emma left and left with Thomas Wells.
Mm-hmm.
Abandoning his four children and wife to be with Emma.
Right.
And why would Emma not respond to the SOS?
That's exactly.
Unless she was already, unless she passed away by then too. Like,
right.
You know, I mean, it's not impossible. She could have actually left mm-hmm. with Thomas Wells and lived a life with him and died
right.
in some other way, so it had nothing to do with the deathbed confession.
Right.
That's what's interesting about the deathbed confession is, you know, I'm wondering if Lillian, while she was watching this man
mm-hmm.
and tending to him, would tell him about her missing sister, and maybe he always felt bad about it and wished that he could do something, and when he
right.
died, when he was passing away, he said, oh, you know, I did it, and I threw her bicycle in a pond and her body.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't even make
yeah.
sense, because, like, that wouldn't make her feel better.
No.
What
no.
would make her feel better is if he was like, I know what happened to her. It wasn't me, but here's who did it.
Right.
So
I would think Lillian would make the connection.
That's why
too.
It's so weird. Like, why would he even mention that?
Well, that's why I'm actually, I do place a lot of stock in that deathbed confession, just because once the police announced that they determined that she had eloped to Ireland, they didn't actually do anything else about looking into the Ireland side of it. There's actually no conclusive proof that she moved to Ireland with Thomas. The only proof that they have is that time difference, the 26,
mm-hmm.
1926 versus 1928, that he disappeared at the same time, and the argument that her mother and Thomas's wife had in public. And it's weird because looking on Ancestry, you can usually find the stuff. You can narrow it down.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the police don't have any further information about this, they don't have any other, you know, smoking gun that says, oh yeah, they were in Dublin or they were in Galway or anything like that at this time. So I kind of feel like maybe they just wanted to close the case and they thought that was strong enough for them because they did actually search the ponds. They did make inquiries with people in the area. But, I mean, if nothing came of it, maybe he just thought that, you know, I've got better cases to spend my time on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to choose that she went to Ireland with this man because it was at the same time. So.
But I guess they don't have any evidence to support that because.
No. So what do I mean?
So the only evidence that they are basing that on is that Emma's mother and Thomas's wife got in an argument once.
Right, right.
But how else would Emma be attached to Thomas Wells? Like, was she having an affair with him, and there's some proof?
Yeah, there's nothing.
Well, then I would throw that out, because I
yeah.
don't think there's really any way to corroborate that.
Right. And, I mean, I can understand the police not wanting to spend more time on it. But
not only, yeah, I mean, for someone to leave their four children and their wife,
yeah.
it just seems
Which
odd.
Which it happens. I mean, but granted, they're in the wrong country. They're, unless, we don't know that his wife was Irish, I guess. So possibly his wife was actually British, and he had moved over there and met her in England and then went back to Ireland
mm-hmm.
years and years later after they'd had kids and were married.
Right.
So perhaps that's what happened, but I don't know. I don't really feel like that's true. Because, well, again, where's her bicycle? Why are so many members of her family placing all of this trust in this deathbed confession? And then, you know, what happened? Why didn't she make contact with her family?
Yeah.
Because even if she moved to Ireland, if they knew about it, which is what the public argument between her mother and Thomas's wife would indicate, there's no reason she couldn't still be in contact with her family, write letters or...
Yeah, at least drop a line. I mean, it's so long for...
Exactly. So, I mean, I'm still kind of stuck on the deathbed confession. Maybe it's just that I want it to be a little bit more than her just running away. But because I don't feel like, I feel like she put her family through a lot of stuff if that's really the case. If her sister believed that she had been murdered in the 50s when she was tending that man, that's really a horrible thing to do to your sister.
Yeah. I mean, I agree.
So I mean, that's the story, which I kind of love.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it really, you could go so many directions with it. I mean, it's, you know, the longer you keep a secret, it just seems like the farther away you get from the truth because you know, here's Lillian who didn't tell anyone for years. This man didn't tell anyone for years, and so it's just so much time has gone by.
Yeah.
So it's, you get to the point where it's like, who knows what happened.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think it's kind of cool.
It is cool.
But it was a fun story. I was actually researching historical murders, and that one popped up, and I was like, oh,
yeah,
we have to do this one. This one's interesting.
That is so interesting.
And I'm a huge, like, British history fan to begin, or
I can tell.
Person to begin with. So yeah, I do more than just watch Downton Abbey, I promise.
Yeah.
I also watch Victoria. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, I read a lot about it and
that's
that
cool.
kind of stuff. So I love learning about the lifestyles back then as well. But yeah, I mean, I hope, part of me kind of hopes maybe she did just run away because, I mean, it's better than being murdered, obviously. But then the other part of me is like, why would she do that to her family?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well,
yeah, that
cool.
That was
well.
Pretty cool.
I found a couple that were deathbed confessions, but they're not in Britain. They
oh,
are
okay, cool.
they're right here in the U.S. in Virginia, and
Whoa.
They're very. So the first one, I have to throw this in there. So much as you like your British history,
yes,
I love a good alien story.
Oh yeah,
because
those are fun too.
I love a good like I saw a UFO story. Those are like my guilty pleasure. So I found this article, and let me just say that there's some bad grammar in the article, so I'm not sure if it's actually true, but I'm going to post a link in the show notes just so that people can read it. It's pretty weird, but let me just get right into it here. So a guy named Paul Epley, Army Master Sergeant, First Sergeant, and Company Commander in his 80s, confessed that he saw an alien in a bunker guarded by his friend whom he served with in Guam. He was visiting Camp Peary in Williamsburg, Virginia in the summer of 1950 and concluded that it was a live Roswell alien. I don't know how he knows that it was a Roswell alien. Like, did he ask the alien, hey, did you land
in Roswell?
Because, whatever, no. I didn't get that impression. But I think back then it was just assumed that if there was an alien, it's so weird to say that. Like
in Virginia, too.
Yeah.
We're not known for aliens.
Well, it's like, how did they get him here? I don't know. I'll get into that.
Yeah.
But like, and so he said he was visiting Camp Peary, and his friend was who he had served with in Guam was guarding this bunker. So he went up to his friend, and he starts chatting with him and says, like, you know, and I guess his friend eventually is like, all right, I'll tell you what's in the bunker. And so he opens the door to the bunker, and the alien was standing about 15 to 20 feet from Paul in a 3 to 4 foot square cage wearing just briefs.
Can I tell you, that's my favorite part of that whole story.
And it reminds me of Roger from American Dad.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it says Paul describes his skin tone as being old and old, orange-gray, dead-looking color.
Hmm.
I have so many questions about this that I'm just like, first of all, why are you waiting until you're on your deathbed to tell anybody that you saw an alien? And maybe it was just because, you know, it was the 50s, and maybe, I understand, like, you don't want to tell people right away.
Right.
But you're going to wait until you're dying to tell someone that you saw an alien once? I think you probably would have been safe in 1960 to tell someone, like, I don't know. And I'm wondering who, how did the alien get to the said bunker? Mm-hmm. Like, did they put him on a flight? Like, how does that work, you know? I mean, I guess the government flew him over.
First class?
I have so many questions. Yeah, like, what, they put him in a cargo plane that's a military plane. Nobody asks any questions.
Right.
They transport him to Camp Perry, which I'm sure has a landing strip.
Yeah.
And it's a done deal.
I don't know. That cracks me up.
Not sure if I believe the story, but I think... Again, it's like, why would you wait until you're on your deathbed? That's not a secret I would keep. That's like an anecdotal story that I would tell at like a dinner party.
Oh, yeah.
Like, guys, you'll never believe what happened to me this week.
That's what you bring out when everybody else is talking about their ghost stories.
Exactly. And he waits. You know, I guess I would have said something earlier, but again, I did not grow up in the 1950s. I have no idea what, you know, that environment was like. And, you know, the Roswell thing brings up a lot for people. It was during a really interesting time in our country. So I can imagine in his position, you know, he probably didn't want to get his friend in trouble either.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, you know, I saw this alien, and I'm sure all these people would ask questions like, well, who showed it to you? And then if it got back to the Army, that guy could have been discharged.
Or disciplined really.
I guess I get it now. But.
Yeah, but still, I mean, I would at least want to tell
one person. Can you imagine, though, seeing an alien?
Yeah.
It's in a cage, and you're just like, what do? Do you just say, okay, and close the door?
Which, again, can I just say how horrible that is of us?
I know,
put a little guy in a cage.
We do it all the time.
I know, and it bothers me, but, I mean, also, this alien, for some reason, reminds me of Meatballs 2.
I never saw that.
You didn't?
No.
Okay. Well, I don't remember what the alien looked like, but that's who I'm picturing in this little cage where all these little boys find him and start dragging him around the camp and pretending he's a camper.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was a horrible movie, but it was still funny.
Or what is that movie, Paul? Right?
I think.
What is the one with the alien that. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
The little alien, and he's like CGI. Which is interesting that his name is Paul, because this guy in the story's name is Paul.
Home?
Huh?
Was it the movie Home? Was it animated?
It was just the alien was CGI and everything else was real.
I don't know that one, maybe.
Was it Paul? I have to look it up, but I'm going to
tell you. Oh, wait, it was Paul.
Yeah, right. And that's interesting because this guy from the Army's name is Paul. Maybe it was based on,
Actually, I couldn't.
Maybe.
Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if it did, or if it didn't.
We just solved the mystery.
Actually, I think it was based on this, because Seth Rogen played Paul, unless Paul was the alien, and he just did
Paul is the alien.
Okay, I've never seen this one before. That's kind of crazy.
So we just solved a mystery, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, that was...
our work is done.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I have another one that is... just perfect. Okay, so the headline is that a CIA agent in Virginia confesses to killing Marilyn Monroe. Oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
So of course I had to click on this when it showed up. His name was Normand with an D on the end. Not Norman.
Okay, so like
Normand Hodges.
Like the screen star Mabel Normand from like The Silent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's something I didn't know.
Yeah.
Retired CIA agent, confesses on deathbed in Norfolk, Virginia, that he killed Marilyn Monroe.
Huh.
So he admits to committing 37 assassinations between 1959 and 1972. So this.
Jeez, dude.
So let me back up for a second. So this is what I would think someone would confess on their deathbed.
Yeah.
So you want it, you know, he's putting it all out there.
Right.
And he says that he worked as an operative for 41 years with high-level clearance, trained as martial arts expert and sniper. He was trained in poisons and explosive expert.
Really?
All his assassinations were commanded by Major James Jimmy Hayworth.
Oh, so we're even name dropping here.
His operative, he says it all. It says his operative cell included five members, who handled political assassinations, mostly activists, union leaders, and journalists. Ugh.
Oh my gosh.
Not podcasters, just
thank goodness.
Journalists.
Just even, watch your back.
Yeah. Even a few artists and scientists whose ideas threatened the interests of the United States.
Huh.
Marilyn, he claims, was his only female victim, and she was considered a threat for the security of the country.
Huh.
Claims they had hard evidence that she not only slept with John F. Kennedy, and I'm about to drop a bomb here, but also with Fidel Castro.
Okay.
I don't know, like, I had heard about the JFK relationship, but
yeah.
Never... Fidel Castro.
No, I've never heard of that. That's crazy.
So, as you can imagine, that's kind of crazy. And then
yeah.
It says that Hodges says he was, or she was a threat and could transmit information to the communists, according to his commanding officer, Hayworth.
Okay.
Hayworth told Hodges it had to look like a suicide or an overdose.
Oh, wow.
Which, as we know, it did. Hodges said he entered Marilyn's room on the night of August 5th, 1962, and injected her with chloral hydrate mixed with Nembutal, which led to her death.
Wow.
Hodges was 78, and he was placed in FBI custody to have
his
statements verified. That is, I mean, this is a serious...
Yeah, that's true.
There was very little written evidence on this to corroborate his story.
Shoot.
So, basically... Jimmy Hayworth ordered people to be killed, and there's not really any documentation of it, which is,
makes
me feel really good.
If there's, but then again, it's the CIA. If
right.
There's no documentation of it.
It never
that
happened.
That was probably
right.
Planned.
Yeah, well, yeah. So,
that's
so crazy.
I mean, we knew about John F. Kennedy.
We knew about JFK, but Fidel Castro, I mean, was he...
Any proof of that anywhere?
I have no idea. I didn't even research it. I guess I could. But it says that the most important witness, of course, is James Hayworth.
Right.
Who died of a heart attack in 2011.
Okay.
And there were two other CIA assassins who are also deceased. And so remember, he was part of a 5-person operation. So if he includes James Hayworth in that 5...
Mm-hmm.
So that's 3 of the 5 have now died, and if you include him,
okay.
Normand is now dead, so that leaves 1 person.
Wow.
And it says the last assassin was Captain Keith McInnes, who was reported missing in action in 1968 and is presumed dead.
Oh, wow.
So if he is in fact alive, he may know if that story is true.
Yeah, I wonder if he was in, since he's missing in... 68, I would assume he's dead by now, though.
So...
Wouldn't that be Vietnam? More than likely?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm assuming they're when they say missing in action, they are either referring to Vietnam, or they're talking about just... If he was just an operative and he was on some sort of mission, then...
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think... Missing in action is missing in action of war. Like you're
that's what
in war.
Consider it as. This is fascinating. I mean, I didn't. It's funny because I don't. My grandfather, my mom's dad, actually worked for Kennedy.
Wow.
Years ago. Yeah, he passed away in 1959, so it was before Kennedy became president.
Oh wow.
But, this is why I would actually love to check with my family and see if they had any knowledge of. The whole Fidel Castro thing, or if they remember anything. I mean, my mom was only like 10 or 11 when all of this happened, when this would have happened, but still, that's kind of fascinating. And I love the picture in here, in the article, which I'm assuming we'll get the article up on the blog.
Yeah.
But I love the picture of Hodges, he's got his arms in the air and he's got handcuffs.
Yes.
He's handcuffed to the bed. So he looks like old and frail, and I feel kind of bad for him, but...
Well, it sounds like he just wanted to get some stuff off his chest, and he couldn't live. He couldn't die knowing that nobody knew what happened to Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
So I would say,
this is more believable to me than the
alien
story.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the CIA is confirming that he was indeed an operative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that they can't corroborate.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're not, though. Maybe they're saying, well, we're actually not.
If it's
well,
classified.
Hold on. It says that he's... it says he's a retired CIA agent.
Yeah.
So I guess what they're corroborating is his story and not his position in the CIA.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think they're saying, okay, he is this person, but we need to figure out if what he's saying is true.
Right. And if that's classified.
If it's classified. Well, the other thing is, like, if it was an order by James Hayworth.
Yeah.
It's not illegal, right?
No. I mean, if it's a CIA, I would assume if it's some sort of CIA operation.
Does Marilyn Monroe have any relatives still living?
I don't know.
And she didn't have
I'm
children.
I'm sure she does, but
did
not
she have children?
Close to her. No.
She didn't have children?
No, I think she may have had a miscarriage with Joe DiMaggio, but that's, she never actually had any living children.
Okay. And so are there any living relatives? I'm sure there are.
I've never heard of it. I mean, I'm sure there are. I'm guessing, like, cousins or maybe nieces or nephews or,
yeah.
You know, great-nieces. I don't think there's any... I haven't heard of any, like... She doesn't have any brothers or sisters, did she? So I guess maybe there wouldn't be any nieces or nephews. For some reason, I don't feel like she had brothers and sisters, but maybe she did. Are there...
Norma Jean Mortensen.
Okay.
Also known as Norma Jean Baker.
I don't know why I feel... Oh, look, her family tree.
Her family tree is out there.
That's perfect.
We can post this as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that this is a can of worms. I mean, they really can't corroborate it, so...
Right. And it looks like she did have a brother, at least.
Norma Jean Baker with her mother, Gladys. Oh, sorry, it's pop-up. Okay, we're not gonna...
That was terrifying.
That was scary. It's the ghost of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah. She's letting us know that it's true.
Yeah, she's like, guys, it's true. So there you have it.
So, yeah, we know who killed Marilyn Monroe.
We saw it.
So, yeah, this was a fun little topic.
It was.
To do. I like these kinds of things where we don't necessarily have the answers, but they're... Some of them are crazy, like the alien story, which now I want to go look into that.
I'm definitely looking into that.
Yeah, I need to know more about that. But yeah, I mean, this was fun, and we'll be back. We won't be as long of a hiatus next time. We promise.
Yes.
So check us out on Twitter, Crime Quest Pod. What is it? Facebook. We've got a Facebook group that's we want to get a little bit more active, so come join us there. Instagram, Crime Quest Pod, or you can email us at crimequestpod@gmail.com. Send us any of your ideas. It doesn't have to be murder. It can just be crazy crime stories that you want us to cover.
Or even just weird stories.
Yeah,
Like this, like deathbed confession, or you saw something weird, or...
Yeah.
You know, this weird thing always happens to me when I, you know, ghost stories or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we love stuff like that. So trying to branch out a little bit on our topics. And we're going to get a little bit more active on social media, too.
Yep.
We've been slacking.
It's been a busy couple of months.
Yeah.
So, but we will be back in about 2 weeks with another episode. And have a great week, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Crime Quest. It is our goal to make this as informative as possible. If you heard something amazing and want to give us a review, please do so on iTunes along with a rating. If you have suggestions for show topics, please send them to crimequestpod@gmail.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @CrimeQuestPod. Thanks. Crime Quest would like to give special thanks to Hemi Haynes for putting together our music for this episode. Thanks, Hemi!